Ingram with the Standing Committee for Community Safety, chaired obviously by the Honourable Wenger. So I'll spin my laptop, Ralph, and then you can see everybody, and then we're all on the same page at the same time, and then we'll sort of
okay,
take it
as very good.
I'm just making sure I don't disconnect things. So you tell me, I hope I'm getting everybody in there. Am I?
Yep, good afternoon, everyone.
Fantastic.
All right. Good afternoon to you, sir, and a good morning to us here. A very warm welcome to the Standing Committee on Community Safety in the Western Cape Provincial Parliament. My name is Mireille Wenger. I'm the chairperson of the Standing Committee. To my right is Mr. Wasim Matthews, who's our committee coordinator. And just behind you is Ms. Marianne Burgess, who's assisting us with the Hansard and with the logistics this morning. I will then ask the members to introduce themselves for the record.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Daylan Mitchell.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Trudy Tijana. Morning.
Good morning, Fern Christians.
Right, and then we have Mr. Lester here this morning. Very warm welcome.
Thank you.
As well as Mr. Ralph Clark, who's joining us via Skype from San Francisco. So if you'd like to just introduce yourself briefly for the record as well, please.
Fantastic. Thank you. My name is Ian Lester. I'm the chief executive of a company called Beyond Wireless. To clarify the relationship between ourselves and ShotSpotter, we are the local implementation and support partner for ShotSpotter here in South Africa, and we assist them with setting up meetings like this, obviously demonstrating the system, implementing the system, as well as providing training and support for our local partners here in South Africa. And Ralph, I'll allow him to do his own introduction.
Sure, very well. Good morning, everyone. Again, my name is Ralph Clark, and I'm the president and CEO of ShotSpotter, based here in Silicon Valley in the United States.
Thank you very much for joining us. We'd also like to welcome Mr. Guido Morris from the Department of Community Safety, the head of department, who's also joining us this morning. And we'd also like to welcome the Parliamentary Monitoring Group and members of the public joining us this morning. And we do have two apologies. Honourable Kibido and Honourable Lecker are unfortunately not able to join us this morning. All right, so just by way of context, this morning is part one of two meetings that we will be having regarding ShotSpotter. ShotSpotter is something that has been very much on our radar, something we've heard quite a lot about in our engagements with the Cape Town Metropolitan Police Department. They have invited us to come and see the technology and to understand a bit better about how it works and what gains have been made. So this morning we're very grateful to have you here to understand the more technical side and what the intention of the program is and how it works exactly. And then in June we will be going on a site visit to the operations center to see it in action, as it were. This is indeed a very important meeting for us this morning. And we extend a very warm welcome. So, members, we'll then hand over to Mr. Lester and Mr. Clark to present to us. We'll have some questions thereafter, and we will then deal with our committee administration right at the very end. All right, so on that note, over to you.
Fantastic. And thank you once again, Honourable Wenger, for the invitation and to the committee. It truly has been a privilege working with the City of Cape Town and indeed SAFs on this project, and yeah, I think I speak for Ralph where, yeah, this is more than just business for us. Yeah, we feel like we need to make a contribution in solving the problem of gang violence and gun violence. So as a starting point in terms of the process and the agenda that I think we'd like to follow, what we normally do, Ralph and I, and we've done this a few times, is to keep it fairly informal and conversational. It's not intended to be a speech or us preaching to you. If you have any questions at any point, please stop us. We welcome those questions. We like that kind of engagement, and we think that works well. So, Ralph, I'm going to spin you back to me if you don't mind. I'll abuse you with my ugly face once again.
We should probably just let Mr. Clark know that he is beamed up on the big screen, so we can all see you, even though you might not be able to see us.
Ralph often jokes that he doesn't put on his makeup, even if the meeting is as late as it is. Ralph.
It is as good as it gets.
Great. So Ralph, as per usual, if you maybe want to just start off with an introduction and an overview of ShotSpotter, the background to the business, et cetera, and just give an overview of A, who and what you guys are and what it is that you do. And then from there, what I think we'll do, Ralph, is get into the brief presentation which I shared with you on really the things that drive ShotSpotter, both from a technical perspective as well as some of the softer issues. And then we'll do a brief demonstration of the actual live system. And of course, again, we'll have Q&A as well. So if anybody's got any questions, feel free to jump in. And then we'll also obviously explain the system with a very brief video once Ralph is done. So Ralph, I'll hand it over to you.
Excellent. Well, look, I'll be very brief so we can actually get into the conversation. So just very quickly, by the way, of background, ShotSpotter was founded about 20 years ago by a doctor, Bob Schoen, who's both quite a brilliant engineer and scientist, as well as an incredibly beautiful human being. And here in the Bay Area, or Silicon Valley, he was known as the father of the epicenter of things. He had been working with an entity called Stanford Research Institute using math to figure out the epicenter of earthquakes, Soviet Union missile testing and the like. And he became concerned about a local gunfire issue in a city here in California called Redwood City, and had the notion that he could apply these same math principles of triangulation acoustically to be able to identify, detect, and locate and alert on outdoor gunfire. So he ended up leaving his job at Stanford Research Institute to found the company, and ended up recruiting a couple of other quite brilliant engineers and mathematicians from MIT. We have a bunch of PhDs as a part of our team, and they developed the original system of ShotSpotter that was first deployed in Redwood City, the city he was concerned about, and since that time, we've been deployed in about 85 cities, mostly in the U.S., with, of course, the exception we're really proud of in Cape Town, South Africa. Mostly, I would say, our real inspiration as a company is really to provide a tool to allow law enforcement and communities to denormalize gun violence. The thing here that we've experienced in the U.S., and I'm told and understand and to some degree in Cape Town, is that most gunfire goes unreported. Here in the U.S., about 80 to 90% of gunfire incidents go unreported by residents, which means, of course, there's no police response, which means that the serial trigger pullers continue to pull their triggers and, in the process of doing that, hurt and kill people, not only directly, but also vicariously. We have a notion here in the U.S. of vicarious victimization, which means that people that are exposed to the incidents of gunfire, although not directly and physically hit, are nevertheless negatively impacted in a significant way. So the thing that we like to do is work with police departments to denormalize gun violence and allow an agency to become aware in real time, very precisely, of where these incidents of gunfire are happening, allow them to respond very quickly and safely to these incidents, and if they're not encountering a trigger puller at that specific time, they're likely to cover physical forensic evidence, be able to interview witnesses, but certainly most importantly, show the community that they not to respond and end up building up that community trust, which then incorporates the investigative process and prosecution process, because you get much more community participation and engagement. So I'll hit the pause button there, maybe, and if there's any questions, happy to answer them about the company, or we can go right into the presentation and conversation if you'd like.
That pretty much sums it up. So if there's, unless there's any questions, I'll just get into an overview of how it works.
Can we proceed, members?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, please.
Fantastic. Thanks, Ralph. I'm just going to switch screens quickly. Cool. So what are we going to show you guys? A very brief 3-minute video. We're just giving an explanation of how the technology works, from a systems perspective. And then again, if there's any questions, feel free to jump in. And then what we'll also then do is just get into some of the issues that Ralph has already touched on around why ShotSpotter is important, what it aims to do, what it aims to achieve. And then we'll show you the system and then take it from there. So here we go.
A gun is fired, somewhere. So what happens now? In the past, there was a slim chance the shooting would be reported to police at all. Even when it was, it took precious time, and there was often confusion regarding the location of the shooting and other pertinent information. At least, that's how things were. ShotSpotter has changed all that. By utilizing advanced technology, we have automated the process, We monitor gunfire activity 24/7 throughout the world. Now, if a gun is fired in any area worldwide with ShotSpotter coverage, our system detects, locates, and immediately alerts police of the gunshot. So, how does it work? It starts with sensors. In every area with ShotSpotter coverage, specialized acoustic sensors are placed on buildings or lampposts throughout a neighborhood. If a gun is fired anywhere in the area, multiple sensors detect and timestamp the sound. The precise location of the gunshot is determined based on the amount of time it takes for the sound of the gunshot to travel to each individual sensor, effectively triangulating the sound. The exact location of the detected gunshot is indicated by a dot on a map. That location is derived from a sophisticated set of algorithms. Using multilateration, time difference of arrival, and triangulation based on arrival calculations to generate mass-based intersecting hyperbole. Fortunately, you don't have to worry about that. We do it all for you. Once an alert is generated, it is immediately sent to our IRC, or Incident Review Center, where trained acoustic experts then analyze each incident in mere seconds, determining if the sound is gunfire. SST acoustic analysts receive extensive training on reviewing and classifying gunfire by distinguishing gunshots from other impulsive sounds that are not gunshots. In addition, they are trained to append additional contextual information, such as multiple shooter alerts or full automatic weapons alerts, that can prove to be essential tactical intelligence for law enforcement agencies responding to these crimes. The entire transaction takes place in just 30 to 45 seconds. With the real-time ShotSpotter alert, police can immediately be dispatched to the scene. Utilizing the gunfire audio clip and tactical information, officers can approach an exact location quickly and safely to engage the shooter, interview witnesses, and collect key evidence at the crime scene. ShotSpotter has also launched a new mobile app for anytime access anywhere to gunfire alerts, providing law enforcement the flexibility to receive real-time alerts quickly and effectively without having to be tied to their patrol car or laptop. The ShotSpotter alert system is an invaluable tool in the area of crime fighting, helping make communities safer as well as reducing risks for police officers.
Fantastic. So I think that gives you an overview of the technology. If there's any questions, yeah, we're happy to field them. Is everybody comfortable with sort of the principles from the technology side?
So, Chief, are there any questions at the stage? I have two questions, if I may.
Sure.
So the first is this system able to distinguish between different types of weapons, so between a pistol or a higher caliber kind of weapon?
No, so we can't tell caliber, so we won't be able to differentiate between 9mm or 45, etc. The only difference we can tell is the difference between regular semi-automatic fire or revolver fire or automatic fire. And the way we're going to pick that up is the booms, the pops, or the bangs are going to have a different cadence. So obviously a pistol would be sort of a bang, 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 whereas an automatic weapon is going to be between 600 and 700 rounds per minute, which you can very, very quickly pick up from the acoustic the audio that we detect. In Cape Town's case, we've only ever had that once, and that was in the early days of the pilot, where we had one activation, which was a 25-round incident that had a cadence of over 700 rounds per minute. But that's happened once in a space of 3 years. Nobody was injured during that incident, but it was unusual. And again, even in Ralph's case, I think the vast majority of the time, it's handguns that are being used, assault rifles, and certainly automatic assault rifles are not common. But that's the only differentiation we'd be able to make.
Yeah, I would add though, it's pretty interesting to be able to detect a event where multiple shooters are involved. So that is a situation where you're obviously not detecting the caliber of the weapon, but the fact that you know there's two shooters involved in a particular incident could be very important from a dispatcher response point of view.
Yeah. And we often see that as well. I mean, the gunfights, particularly in the Cape Flats that we've seen, are seldom one-sided affairs. There's often multiple shooters exchanging gunfire, and the ability to see that event play out is obviously tactically important for responding law enforcement officers.
Thank you. And then the second question is, I'm sure you get it all the time, about concerning privacy concerns, whether the sensors are able to pick up people's conversations, or is it only the bangs is the word that it came to take.
Absolutely. So Ralph, you want to jump in on that or should I answer it?
No, please, go ahead.
Cool. Okay, so these are not microphones. They are acoustic sensors specifically programmed to only detect booms, pops, or bangs. So they're not permanently listening to ambient noises and other things that are going around. They only pick up booms, pops, and bangs, and that's when they wake up and essentially upload the audio file. They record 1 second, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ralph, but it's 1 second before the incident and 1 second after the incident. During that happening, there may be other noises where you might hear people scream or other sounds that are happening, but these are not listening to recordings of people's conversations. It is only the acoustic the sound file that occurs during that shooting incident that we pick up, and as I said, 1 second before and 1 second after. So these are not in any way, shape, or form listening to people's conversations, and they're not invading anybody's privacy. And I know, Ralph, this is an issue that often comes up in the U.S. Yeah, for all the obvious and right reasons. So if you want to add to that, feel free to jump in.
Yeah, no, I think you nailed it.
Okay, fantastic.
Honorable Deanna?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I've got only two questions. My first question is on the issue of its deployment. Where else is ShotSpotter deployed here in South Africa? And then my second question is on the gunshots from gun silencers. Does ShotSpotter detect the gunshot from the silent guns?
Suppressed weapons. I'll answer both. So in Cape Town, we have a deployment here in Hanover Park in Manenberg, which is in Cape Town. We've also had a pilot recently in Nelson Mandela Metro Bay in an area called Helenvale, also deeply troubled by gang violence, a very similar situation to what we have here in Cape Town. And again, which you may have seen in the press, we had some amazing results and statistics from a very brief pilot that we had in Helenvale with Councillor John Best and SAPS as well as Metro Police. And it was incredibly encouraging to see how quickly the community responded to that. And we also ran a pilot in Johannesburg in an area known as Westbury. On the western side of Johannesburg, again an area troubled by gang violence, drug trade, and so on. So we've had three deployments in South Africa. The only one that is commercially active and contracted is the city of Cape Town. The other cities have run very brief pilots, essentially to expose them to the art of the possible and trying to expand what we're doing here in other metros. We've also recently engaged with the Gauteng provincial government, MEC in Nkosi Marubani, and we are also looking at a deployment in an area known as Eldorado Park in Johannesburg, also deeply troubled by gang violence. We know it's an area that MEC in Nkosi Marubani is deeply passionate about, and we've approached them as well and are working with their team on possibly looking at a deployment in Eldorado Park as well. On the issue of suppressed weapons, suppressed weapons, and I think this is clear, it's not just suppressed weapons. There are certain types of gunfire that we may not detect. I think the quoted statistic that ShotSpotter uses that we will accurately and reliably detect on about 80% of gunfire that occurs. In truth, it's probably closer to 90%, maybe a little bit more than 90%, but there are certain types of gunfire that we may not detect. Low caliber weapons, so like a 22 caliber firearm, which is very light in caliber, is going to make a much softer bang than a 9mm or a 40 or a 45. Those we may not pick up. A suppressed weapon could also be problematic, but then there's other physical factors as well, and forgive the graphic description, but often if a shooter walks up to somebody and shoots him point blank range, because the acoustic energy is essentially absorbed into the body of the victim, and the boom or the bang or the pop is not allowed to travel. Remember, we need three or more sensors to participate in an event in order to be able to accurately and reliably locate onto that position. So if the acoustic energy is absorbed into the target, we may not detect it. Similarly, if a weapon is fired from inside a vehicle, so a typical drive-by shooting, where the acoustic energy of the muzzle blast is contained within the vehicle, as much as you might hear that bang, enough sensors may not participate to allow us to locate onto it. And also shooting that occurs obviously indoors or fired into a building or into a car from close range or in very tight alleys, those are the things we may not detect. But we're confident to say that probably, as I said, 80 to 90% of the shooting that occurs, we detect and accurately locate. So like all systems, it has its limitations, but certainly the vast majority of gunfire is going to be reliably detected. By the way, just interestingly, which is an aside, but it's probably interesting, is we did also deploy this. You've asked where else it was deployed. A couple of years back, we deployed this in the Kruger National Park. In fact, that was the first time ShotSpotter was deployed in South Africa to detect rhino poaching. And in that particular case, we did test both suppressed and unsuppressed weapons with absolutely no degradation in our ability to reliably detect. And the difference being is that when you're shooting Rhino, you're using very high caliber, very powerful weapons, and you cannot suppress or sufficiently suppress rifle fire in order for the system not to work. And there we were detecting gunfire at 1.8 miles, both suppressed and unsuppressed weapons with an accuracy of half the size of this room. So, when you're talking rifle fire, it really makes no difference. Handgun fire, of course, it does make a difference. I think an important point, however, from a suppressor perspective is that suppressors are both extremely difficult to come by. It requires a very specific kind of weapon. The weapon has to be gunsmithed in order to accommodate a suppressor, and it also makes the weapon very difficult to conceal. A suppressor typically adds 30 centimeters onto a firearm, which makes it far more difficult for a gangster to conceal a weapon with an extra foot of metal on the front of it. We don't typically see
it's very hot after they fire it, so they can't put it in their pocket after they used it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you could, but that would get interesting.
Yeah.
Any questions from the other members? Honorable questions?
Fantastic. So what I'm really just going to cover now is a very, and I'm a firm believer in the concept of death by PowerPoint. So this is a very brief 7-slide overview of some of the things that Ralph has already touched on, but I'd like to reinforce some of those points. Yeah, and a lot of them are perhaps not as obvious as you would. We always think of ShotSpotter, the obvious stuff. It's about catching bad guys and getting guns off the street. But I think there's some more subtle aspects to ShotSpotter which are equally important to communicate. So I'm just going to take you guys through that. Ralph has already touched on this one, is that contrary to what people may think, is that the vast majority of gunfire actually goes unreported. Typically in violence-affected communities, people become so desensitized to gunfire that unless somebody is actually wounded or killed, they tend not to bother. Yeah, and the worse the community it is, the worse that effect or that phenomenon becomes. Statistically, and I think this is an American stat, and Ralph, I have some interesting information that we picked up yesterday with our meeting with Cape Town Metro Police and SAPS around Manenberg and Hanover, which I'll share in a second. But essentially, 9 out of 10 times when a gun fires, nobody calls, which means that police, and I don't like the word don't, but rather can't respond, because quite simply they aren't aware of the incident. In the words of Muhammad Ali, your hands can't hit what your eyes can't see. Yeah, and if you don't know about the gunfire, it becomes impossible to respond to that particular incident. So that lack of response creates the perception that police don't care, which of course is an incorrect perception, but when the gun goes off 10 times and only once the police actually arrive on scene, people start to lose faith in law enforcement. And that, in turn, results in people failing to cooperate with law enforcement for two reasons. Number one, the perception that, well, the cops don't care. And number two, there's a fear of retribution. Now, where ShotSpotter really nails these problems is that, number one, because of ShotSpotter, you're going to be able to respond more often with greater location accuracy and in less time. So instead of responding once out of 10 shots, you're probably going to respond 9 out of 10 times. And that starts to this is an important point. It starts to rebuild faith in law enforcement in the sense that the community starts to see that every single time a gun goes bang, the cops actually arrive, and they arrive at the right time within a very short amount of time. And that starts to reinforce and rebuild faith in law enforcement. Equally, and I think the last point, this came up before, is that a lot of people are afraid, rightly so, that if you're living in one of these communities and you're amongst the problem or you're in the problem, the last thing you want to be doing is exposing yourself to risk. So people tend not to cooperate because they're afraid to cooperate. With ShotSpotter, they don't need to essentially report the gunfire and call the cops because the system is doing that for them. So that also de-risks the community in terms of the fact that they don't have to pick up the phone. Yeah, because let's face it, if you're on the street and you see a shooting incident and you pick up the phone and you make a phone call to 107 or 10111, that's probably a life-limiting activity if you were to do something like that. So having a system that essentially does that job for you makes the community a lot safer. Again, a very important point, and again, we all assume that all gangsters are shooters, but in fact, only a very small percentage of the gang community are what we call habitual trigger pullers. It's a very specific kind of individual within the gang who are the guys who do the shooting. Not everybody carries guns and not everybody does the shooting. And what that means is by taking a very small handful of people off the streets, you can have an exponential impact in the war against gun violence, because you know, that guy, he doesn't shoot once. He's probably the same guy who in that particular area is responsible for the majority of the gunfire, or certainly he and you know, a very small group of people who he hangs out with. So that's an important point as well in terms of you know, why ShotSpotter is effective, because if you can catch the right guy, your chances are he's going to stop doing what he's doing, you know, obviously because he's not going to be on the streets anymore. And Ralph has touched on this as well, a lack of intelligence is dangerous. You know, dispatching officers into an active crime scene without all available information is a threat to the officer. And you can imagine the phone call. Somebody calls in and says, I've heard gunfire on my street. You know, the dispatching officer says, where? He says, well, it's down the road on the, you know, on the corner of X and Y. Not knowing where the exact location of that shooting incident was, the officer essentially enters that scene blind. And he's having to deal with information as it comes in. Knowing where the shooting occurred, so it was in the alley or it was behind the building, means the officers are able to respond a lot safer and with a lot more caution, which places them at less risk. Also places the public at less risk. Because if you're an officer walking into an active crime scene where you know there's just been a shooting and your firearm is drawn and there are other people in the area, the risk of having something go wrong where the wrong person gets a gun pointed at them, that puts the public at risk as well. So having more information around where the shooting occurred, etc., means that it's a lot safer to respond. And again, Ralph touched on this, is that rapid and accurate response to a crime scene that you're more likely to get reliable eyewitness accounts, better crime scene investigation, and fresher evidence, all of which is crucial in the prosecution process. Now, we're quite pleased to say that in Cape Town's case, we currently have two incidents where we had a ShotSpotter activation that have led directly to the arrest and prosecution of suspects, and ShotSpotter is actually part of the evidence pack that is going to be used in the prosecution. And we also have a case in the Kruger National Park where a ShotSpotter activation is being used as evidence in a prosecution. It's going to be interesting to see how that plays out in South African courts, because obviously there's no precedent for it, but we're quite excited to see whether or not and how that is used in the actual prosecution of suspects.
You suggested you'd learned something just the other day.
Thanks for reminding me, Ralph. So yes, just yesterday, just on the issue on how many times the actual emergency numbers ring relative to the amount of gunfire. So one of the fellows at the meeting yesterday at Cape Town Metro Police shared with us that in the last month, in fact the month of April, it's been a particularly bad month in both Manenberg and Hanover Park. And in the 1 week when we had over, I think it was 79 activations, he reported to us that the 107 emergency number at Cape Town Metro rang twice. So out of 79 shooting incidents, the phones rang twice. So yeah, even that 9 out of 10 times is probably not even as good as that. In this particular case, you had 79 shooting incidents and people only bothered to call it in twice. And there were also a host of fatalities and injuries. So again, the worse the community, the bigger that problem becomes. Again, another important point, perhaps a little bit more subtle, but yeah, it is a statement of fact to say that you know, when there's violence in communities, businesses shut down. You know, people, jobs are lost, and the people who need work are essentially, they lose those economic opportunities to employment. And it goes without saying that economic productive communities are safer communities. I mean, it's just common sense that if people are working and those communities are economically productive, they will be safer. And Ralph has touched on this as well, the vicarious victim effect. Yeah, and this is something that I know Ralph is particularly passionate about. I share that passion, is that people, particularly children who are exposed to high levels of gunfire, suffer from a host of disorders, learning disabilities, psychiatric disorders, things like post-traumatic stress disorder, a loss of empathy. I mean, I can honestly tell you personally, I have young children, 11 and 7, and having seen the levels of gunfire that we've seen in places like Hanover Park and Manenberg, I shudder to think what my kids would experience and how they would cope living with that kind of gun violence in these areas. And it would be impossible to, A, not only go to school, but even if you did go to school, to be able to learn, retain information, and ultimately get an education, which is we're touching on there. And this is something I would love to be able to see if you have the stats, is during these flare-ups in violence, if you are able to get attendance registers from schools to see what is the effect on school attendance during these flares-up in violence, because if I was a parent living in those communities and I was hearing that gunfire or that, there's no chance I'd be sending my children across any road to attend school. And when you consider the effect of that in terms of getting an education, what that means in terms of economic opportunities when these children grow up, the dropout ratios in school, and if a child doesn't get an education and he drops out of school young, what is he likely to become when he's an adult? A gang member. So this is the cycle of gun violence and gang violence we're trying to interrupt as ShotSpotter. So it's more than just catching bad guys and getting guns off the street. It's ultimately about trying to transform societies over the long term. And Ralph did touch on this, you know, the fact that gun violence becomes normalized. And Ralph once shared a story with me. And Ralph, I think it was in Oakland, California, where you said you rolled in a crime scene. Ralph, much to his organization's unhappiness, has a habit of from time to time rolling onto crime scenes in Oakland. And I think the one you described, Ralph, as we arrived at a crime scene, there was a fatality, there was a dead person lying on the road, he had been covered up, there was cones demarcating the bullet casings, and you see children at a young age, 6 or 7 years old, sitting on the sidewalk, 10 paces from a dead body, and it's like business as usual. So that loss of empathy, that inability to actually understand the gravitas of what has in fact just happened, that infiltrates the psyche of these children, which means when they're adults, they can go from 0 to 100 like that. And if they have an altercation as adults, to resort to violence in a matter of milliseconds is a natural response, because that's what they've seen all day, every day, and that's what they grow up with. So Ralph, if you want to add to something on that, I mean, it's I know it's something that you're quite passionate about.
Yeah, and so in the U.S., there's been quite a number of studies that have looked at the actual neurological effect of trauma on children that goes untreated, and they can actually see it physically in the way the brain develops. There's a specific chemical that gets emitted when children are exposed to high incidence of stress. And it's really disheartening to see. And I think the example that you talked about, Ian, in terms of thinking about how your children would cope with having to be exposed to that level of drama and how it would change them, is exactly the way I think about it as well. In fact, this particular incident that I saw, I thought about my kids, you know, being exposed to that and how they probably wouldn't be able to go to sleep at night. And it's really tragic to see the internal coping mechanisms of children that deal with violence and how they internalize it. And it has to have some kind of outlet somewhere. And sadly, I believe that outlet happens, you know, 5, 10, 15 years later when they're young adults in terms of their turning to, you know, alcohol, drug abuse, teenage pregnancy. We see a lot of that here in the U.S. And in a few cases, those individuals becoming the perpetrators as opposed to victims. So, you know, you're victimized as a child, you become a perpetrator later on in life. And that's the thing that we have to address. In one particular incident, I'll just share this quickly. There's a entity called Bloomberg Philanthropies, and it's funded by the former mayor of New York City called Michael Bloomberg, who was a very wealthy individual who, since leaving politics, has been very interested in helping transform cities the way, in many ways, he transformed New York City. And one of the things that he did was he provided a grant to one of our ShotSpotter deployments here in the U.S. Called Hartford, Connecticut, that is using ShotSpotter not only to provide a response for law enforcement, but also to provide a response to, I'll call it, kind of post-incident therapy care focused on adolescents. So they'll oftentimes kind of go in after the police have the response, they'll bring in a different set of resources to help children develop coping mechanisms that have been exposed to these stressful environments and give them therapy effectively to help treat the trauma that they've been, the psychological trauma that they've been exposed to. And that's probably, of all the things that we do, that's probably one of the most exciting things for me, is to see how the ShotSpotter data that can not only be used in a traditional law enforcement response capability, but also be used to provide therapy services for the most vulnerable amongst us, which are the children. And so I'm quite excited to see how that develops and what some of the outputs of that are going to be. We're going to be monitoring that, of course, over the next couple of years. So that's an interesting, I think, use case that could be applied. And maybe, Ian, if I could, can I talk about one other use case?
Sure.
If that's okay?
Go for it.
Yeah, so we had in Miami, Florida, we had a chief of police there. He would notice you have this big data set all of a sudden that you see the incidence of gunfire by location and time. And one of the things that they noticed in this area or community of Miami is, like, looking at the concentration of gunfire that really happened between kind of 8 p.m. and midnight. And one of the things that they decided to do, they says, hey, look, what if we kept a basketball gym open that typically kind of closed around 7 p.m.? What if we resourced individuals to keep that gym open on Thursday, Friday, Saturday night? We'll keep it open until midnight. And we're going to provide a whole bunch of resources there to have teams and this, that, and the other. And what they found was in doing that, they significantly reduced incidents of gunfire. And I thought that was a really amazing creative use of the data to be able, again, it's not always about just a law enforcement response. It can sometimes be other different responses once you have the data to be able to affect the vitality, I guess, of a community. And just keep the simple act of keeping this gym open from, 7 p.m. to 12 midnight on Thursday, Friday, Saturday really revitalize this particular area. So these are things that can be done to kind of get at the problem of gun violence.
Thanks, Rob. That's cool. I mean, I suppose what you're saying there is that, giving you an alternative to gangbanging, you can go and play some basketball and shoot some hoops as opposed to going to shoot some people. Yeah, I guess it's give them something else to do, which keeps them off the streets.
Yeah, and I think it really leverages the power of the community. So, of course, law enforcement is a one particular response to gun violence, but I think the most cost-effective and enduring response to gun violence is a more engaged, resilient community. And so when you have a community willing to kind of take over a space effectively, they can effectively shape the public safety outcomes. So if you give them a tool to be able to, they're not law enforcement per se, but they are very powerful, I guess, in terms of changing the norms in a community. And kind of just being enough of an agent to bring that about is very powerful.
Excellent. Good. Thanks, Rob. And then, the last thing I'm going to touch on here, which again is the unfortunate sort of repetition of the cycle, is that people who live in these communities often resort to drug and alcohol abuse as a coping mechanism. Again, when I've looked at the dots and I've listened to the level of gunfire on the system, and I asked myself, would I be able to sleep if I lived there? Chances are the only way you're going to sleep is by taking something, and that something might be alcohol or narcotics, and that ultimately fuels this problem of violence. And it fuels the drug trade, which just repeats the cycle over and over again. So by getting guns off the streets and getting gun violence off the streets, again, alcohol abuse may go away, drug abuse may go away, and you ultimately solve the problem from a different angle. So at this stage, if there's any questions, I'm happy to answer them, and then we'll get into a demo and an overview of some of the more what we call proactive interventions that ShotSpotter provides. A lot of it's sort of reactive stuff, but around the data and how the data can be used to understand the patterns of crime. I'd like to get into some of that, and then we'll open up the floor for any additional questions. So, anything else?
Just proceed for the moment, and then we'll park our questions.
Fantastic. Okay. So, what I'm going to show you now, this is, I'm just going to get rid of that. And this is the actual live platform. Just to give you an idea of, I'm just going to give a brief overview. A lot of the statistical stuff, which no doubt you guys will be interested in, will be provided by Alderman Smith as well as the Cape Town Metro Police when you guys meet with them. I think it's on the 8th of June, I think it is. So I'm not going to get into any of the statistical stuff, but essentially what you're looking at here, this is the live system, and unfortunately this is just Mannenberg for the last 24 hours, so we can see we've had, 10 shooting incidents in the last 24 hours. And quite simply what you can look at there is, the dots on the maps demarcate the locations of those shootings. What happens is, just to explain it, so gunshot goes off, sensors detect the boom, the bang, the pop, uploads the information to the servers, the algorithm calculates the location, people in the incident review center confirm that it is in fact gunfire and not something like a car backfiring or a firecracker. That is then published, that dot arrives on the map, comes in on almost like an inbox. I'm not going to show you that part of the system. And the guys in the dispatch room at the control center will then react to that, dispatch law enforcement accordingly. But you can actually see here that this one very tragically, and I got to tell you that it still affects me personally when I actually see this stuff, because these particularly, this was a fatality yesterday at 8:48 yesterday evening. So you can see there's the incident number, 12751 on the 8th of May at 2048-17 at 13 Renostone Road. It was a 12-round incident, so the M demarcates multiple. So if we see an M, that means multiple rounds were fired. If we see a single round fired, and I don't even think we had one yesterday. Oh, we did. Okay, so there's only one incident where it was a single round. Now, a couple of things that give me the creeps about these things is that, the truth is that the vast majority of the shooting that occurs does not result in a victim. Yeah, that's the good bad news. The problem is that every single time there's a projectile that leaves the barrel of a gun, that's the potential that somebody's going to get hit. And often the person who gets hit isn't the intended victim. it's somebody a block away. And in fact, I think that the last arrest that was made, there was a 47-year-old father of two who was not involved in any way, shape, or form in gang activity, and he's the guy who lost his life just because he happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time. So there, if I click on it, you'll see it automatically move to the location. This is exactly what the people in the control room can see. And you can actually see as well, yeah, just from the view, you can see the location of the shooting. And if the shooting was behind a building, sort of getting to what I was referring to earlier, you can sort of, let's go maybe zoom in on that one. You would be able to, if the shot was behind the building, you'd be able to inform law enforcement, listen, it's behind the building, sort of behind the tree or next to the tree, whatever it is. Now, the accuracy is approximately 30 foot of accuracy in terms of radius, but it gives you a good idea of where the shooting is. And also, once you start to gather crime scene information, you know where to start looking for bullet casings. Just on that as well, the sooner you are on the crime scene, the more likely you are to pick up evidence. What we have seen as well in a lot of these communities in Nelson Mandela Metro, children are fascinated by bullet casings. So if you arrive there 30 minutes later, chances of finding those bullet casings are slim because kids are going to pick them up. So chances of actually getting evidence that's going to lead to a prosecution is slim. But there, if we actually click on that one, there's the 12-round incident. Here you can see the narrative. So we can see that standing down, one time fatal, handed over to SAPS, and you can also listen to the acoustics. And it's, I mean, what else could I say? I mean, it just gives you an idea of what's going on. It's horrific. It's gut-wrenching in many cases. And in this particular case, that was a fatal. The one that occurred just after, by the way, so you can see this one is 11:48, 17 seconds, and 20 seconds later, we have another incident, and this was a female who was shot in her upper right leg. So in a space of 20 seconds, two people have been hit by bullets, and that was yesterday night. Exactly. I mean, that sigh is exactly the response. So, again, I'm not going to get into more of that. I'll leave more of that kind of explanation to Cape Town Metro. They are the custodians of the data and the owners of the data. And then the last thing I'd like to share with you is really just some of this proactive stuff on how we can better use the information. I've specifically taken out details. This is an actual project that we ran for 3 months. I've specifically taken out details as to where and so on, but it does give you an idea of the effect of ShotSpotter. Now, we are very, and I stress, and Ralph knows what I'm going to say, I stress we are very cautious to claim victory too early. Reductions in gun violence are transient, sadly. What we see is that you have these reductions, and then a single incident where the wrong guy gets shot by the wrong person can set off a chain of events which literally becomes this contagion of gun violence thereafter. So this is just a three-month period. The reduction is just interesting, but it's not necessarily something that we're going to claim victory on. But just to explain what happened here, this was a three-month pilot, September, October, and November of last year. The first 2 months, we deliberately set about to essentially gather data and put together an operational plan. So the first month was trying to establish the benchmark to say, this is a 1 square kilometer area, by the way. We try to establish a benchmark as to understand what is the true extent of gunfire in that particular location. You can see we had over, 80-odd shooting incidents in a space of 30 days in 1 square kilometer in this particular area. The next month we went up to approximately 90-odd shooting incidents. And from this information, we were able to then develop an operational plan together with the Metro Police as well as SAPS to say, well, how are we going to deal with it? And that operational plan was really reinforced by the information I'm about to show you in a second. But what this is here to show you the impact. So we analyzed it for 2 months. We looked at where the gunfire is occurring, what time of day it was occurring at, what day of week it was occurring at, and then they started to implement the plan and started to respond to gunfire. And what you can see is in the first 2 months, we pretty much had gunfire every single day of the week. Yeah, the blue lines are incidents, the red lines are rounds fired. We had the odd day with zero gunfire, but you can see instantaneously, the minute they started to respond and act on the information and place resources in the right locations, we had multiple consecutive days with zero gunfire, which was deeply encouraging. So that just shows that by responding more often with greater accuracy and less time, you're able to actually suppress gunfire. Now, again, I've taken the names of the streets out for obvious reasons, but why this is powerful is that we were able to identify that 11 streets out of many, many streets, in fact, a couple of hundred streets, contributed towards 64% of the crime. Now, that means ShotSpotter is more than just a reactionary tool where you get a boom and you run, or a bang and you run to that scene and try and catch the bad guys. By analyzing the patterns of gunfire, you're able to now place resources in the area in advance to suppress gunfire. We would far rather suppress it and not have to react to it than having to react and catch a bad guy. So by knowing which streets the gunfire occurs on, we're able to place resources more efficiently and optimize the available resources that we have. that force multiplier effect is crucial, because often we hear the story, we don't have resources, we don't have vehicles. But if you have the, if you have limited vehicles and you can only put so many people in the streets, best you put them where they're most required and where the incident is more likely to occur. Other information we're able to get is time of day, day of week. So we can see here that again, 67% of the shootings occur on Saturday, Friday, Saturday and Sunday. So let your guys take the day off on the Thursday, which is the slowest day of the week, and let them do their overtime on the Fridays, Saturdays and Sundays, because you're going to get a better use of your resources. Similar kind of information in terms of time of day. Don't have your vehicles patrolling 24 hours a day on a set route. Put them on the right road, on the right day of the week, at the right time of the day, and you're going to be far more effective in suppressing gun crime. Yesterday, and I'm going to mention his name because I can honestly tell you I was inspired by this young detective yesterday, Detective Bitboy, maybe you want to write that down. This guy, I have seldom seen a more committed individual in terms of his passion for fighting this stuff, to the extent that he, using his own time and his own vehicle, actually goes and parks his car on the right roads at the right time to make sure that the gangsters know that he's here so they don't shoot each other. And this is an investigating officer who should be investigating crime, putting his own time and effort in to actually stop crime happening in advance. So the point being is that this can be done, and that's one of the areas that I think there's opportunity for improvement by using this data to place resources more effectively in the right location. So that's pretty much what I have to say. So if there's any other questions, just shout. Ralph, I'm going to, you're back on the screen already. So that's pretty much it. So if there's any other questions or comments, we'll gladly take those.
Perhaps I can kick off. So I think, what you were saying about the system being able to improve detection rates, I think is absolutely essential. We went to visit the Forensic Science Laboratory last year, and it was absolutely fascinating. We actually have a very sophisticated ballistics section. And they're able to link through the bullet casings to the guns and these sort of networks of webs of how cases are interrelated. But of course, if they don't have that evidence, then they can't use that technology to be able to secure those kind of convictions. So I think this is absolutely essential to help detectives detect crimes better. But I think the success also then hinges on the response. And I don't know then if this is a question for you or perhaps something we need to ask Metro Police themselves. Because the response would need to be twofold. The one is, if you can get your law enforcement there to secure the crime scene, etc., but then you'd necessarily need SAPs there because they're the ones that would conduct the investigation. So I suppose the question is then, what is the relationship? I mean, you obviously have a formalized relationship with the Metro Police. Do you have a relationship with the South African Police Service as well?
Yeah. Well, to answer the question, I mean, it's probably better posed to Cape Town Metro Police because they coordinate that. But what we have seen, certainly in recent times, is far more participation from SAPs, where more and more SAPs guys are now on the system. They are getting the SMS alerts. They also have the app installed on their phones. And as I said, the detective I mentioned earlier and his team are very proactive in doing this. We don't have a direct relationships with SAPS on this. I know that Cape Town Metro Police are driving that. And in fact, yesterday I had a meeting with Director Peter Roberts, and he actually made the commitment that they're going to have a meeting where they invite the officials from SAPS to share all of this information around where the gunfire is occurring. So the operational relationship is really being run out of the, I think it's called the Traffic Management Center. Where they have a integrated response, so they've got emergency medical services there, they've got Cape Town Metro Police, they've got SAPS officials in that building. So there is cooperation, and I think perhaps you can pose that question to them as to how that's working out. But the more people we can get participating, the better.
Honourable Mitchell?
Thank you, Chair. I just want to latch on, and again, I don't know if it's for you or for SAPS and law enforcement at the city, but surely this is amazing technology, but is this only being used to detect where the actual shot happened? Because if you take it further and you use this information gathered here and you go and further it to crime mapping and enhancing what the information is currently doing, surely and I probably should have started with that, but surely because Hanover Park and Manenberg has been identified as the crime hotspot or gang hotspot, surely you can pick up a trend and ultimately that can be used for crime mapping.
Well, I mean, the short answer is that I know that Metro Police do have crime analysts who look at this information. Yeah, a lot of the stuff which I've shared here, so the time of day, day of week, the street locations, it's very difficult to assume that the same sort of things are happening elsewhere to make those sort of assumptions. If that's what you're suggesting, that we could take Manenberg and Hanover Park and assume that similar sort of things are happening in other areas, I think the problem is so dynamic and so diverse that, you know, different things happen in different areas at different times for different reasons. But I think, Honourable Wenger, what you mentioned earlier, I think a massive opportunity is that fingerprinting that bullet. And when I say that, is that if you pick up a bullet casing in Hanover and you pick up the same bullet casing that's been fired out of the same gun in Ocean View, and then it pops up in Atlantis, that ability to know how that firearm is moving, or is it the gun that's moving, or is it the shooter that's moving? You know, these are the type of things that start to build a very comprehensive picture to understand crime patterning. Who's doing the shooting? Are these guys mobile? Are they moving from one location to the next? And those are the things that I think that's the opportunity of where we can take this. I'm not entirely sure if it's being done yet. But again, I think if you pose that question to the SAPS guys and the Cape Town Metro Police guys, those are important questions, because the power of this system, and again, I'll say it again, it's not about that reaction stuff. It's not about catching the bad guy and getting the gun. It's about understanding what's happening and the root cause that's driving it and trying to catch those small handful of habitual shooters who are doing the majority of the bad work. Let's get those guys up the street and we can transform these societies.
Honourable Diana?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I'm covered by the relationship, because I was also going to pose that question on the relationship between SAPS and ShotSpot. But my other question is on the evidence. Is the court using the ShotSpotter data for evidence?
There are two incidents currently where ShotSpotter has been essentially used as part of the overall, in fact, I'll explain what happens. So ShotSpotter activations that led to the direct arrest of individuals who were involved in shooting. So yes, ShotSpotter is being used. What ShotSpotter do in the States, and they very kindly provided this for us, they have a thing called the Digital Forensic Report, which is essentially a document which has been, where the gunfire data has been analyzed by a subject matter expert. He explains the technology, explains the incident literally shot by shot, play by play, second by second, how it went down. That then gets certified and notarized by an attorney in the US, and that then gets shipped over to South Africa, which will now be submitted as evidence in a prosecution. How that actually works in South African law, that remains to be seen, but certainly as supporting evidence, ShotSpotter can be used as that. And again, Ralph, you might want to add to that I know in the US, ShotSpotter has been used in prosecutions before quite successfully, so maybe if you want to add in on to that.
Sure, yeah, we've been quite successful in using it in prosecutions, and it's been accepted by courts in over 27 states as well as federal court as a forensically sound piece of data that can be presented by a prosecutor to enhance the prosecution of a case. And what's really interesting is when that prosecutor could actually bring the sounds into a jury case that is quite theatrical, as you might imagine, and really kind of puts an advantage, I think, on a prosecutor. So you have the real science behind the information that's being shared in terms of very precise time, very precise location. And then you also have this kind of emotional thing that you can bring to a court case when you can actually play the sound, especially if it involves a homicide case, for a jury to be able to kind of be transported into that scene by listening to the gunshot activity is very, very powerful. So we're still waiting to see how this gets, accepted in South African case law, but we're really excited about doing everything we possibly can to demonstrate the scientific validity, of the data so that prosecutors can use it.
Honourable questions.
Thank you, Chair. Just to latch on to that, I see, Renosa Street in Manenberg is notorious for shooting, and it's been happening for a long, long, long time.
Mm.
If you look at one street, it's Renosa Street. It's one of the streets that contributes the most to the gunfire. So my question is, if you have all this information, why didn't that come down? Because you can walk any day, any time in the Renosa Street, you'll get gunfire.
Mm-hmm.
I know the people that stay there, so people will tell you about those things. So my question just is, if you said that, you know, 11 states contribute to 64%, now, why do we not have a reduction? Because that is the ultimate goal, is to reduce the amount of shootings. And I agree, it's not about the nitty-gritty, it's just to look at the causes and to reduce those. Because, so that is the rhinoceros. But another factor that is very, very important, it's the same individuals doing the same thing. So it seems to me they are not getting caught, they're not getting arrested, or, you know, there's something wrong with conviction or whatever. But it's the same individual. So my question is, why does this not come down, the amount of shootings? You've just mentioned the 13 shots in the roster, but there's people staying there that live with that on a daily basis. And there's children there that does not attend school because of that. The factors that you gave. So we know all the effects of that. But just answer to the answer that I want, why doesn't it reduce the specific streets in Manenberg? Why do we still have continuous shooting all the time in those areas?
I share your frustration, Honorable Christians. Again, to be fair, and perhaps what we have seen, we do, like I said earlier, we had a prolonged period. If you recall, August, September, and October of last year was an absolute nightmare in those areas. Insane levels of gunfire. That was then contained quite well, and we went for a prolonged period of about 6 months where we had very little gunfire. When I say little, very little, by anybody else's standards, very bad, but comparatively very little gunfire. What happened in April, and again, where you're seeing the high incidence of gunfire on Renoster Street, and by the way, Thames Avenue, Sonderend, I mean, I even joked, Sonderend, I mean, the gunfire never ends in that street. It's not funny, but, you know, the levels are crazy. Yeah, and I think what it boils down to is that, like I said, one small incident, and in fact, I think what happened in April was somebody, I think a senior gang member was shot and killed, and it sets off this chain reaction, where they then take revenge, guys come back, and before you know it, the paranoia, and I can only imagine, if I lived there and there was so much shooting, I would probably feel compelled to carry a firearm because I don't know if I'm getting caught in a crossfire. So, you know, when you set off one shooting, another guy gets shot, 10 guys get shot, all of a sudden everybody's got a gun on the street because they're now afraid. So I agree, we're starting to see repeat patterns, and we discussed this yesterday with Cape Town Metro Police Department. What we've also noticed, and again, it's not a joking matter at all, but we sort of reefed up, there's one particular park, I think it's called Launceston Park in Hanover Park, where we sort of joked and said we've got to call this place Ping Pong Park. Because what we see is out of the same literally 30 square meters on the western side of the park and the same 30 square meters on the eastern side of the park, we watch a ping pong battle because I get the alert. So it goes ping on the one side of the street, bang, and then you see bang, bang on this side of the street, and it goes bang, bang on this side of the street. And it goes on for 10 minutes where the guys are exchanging gunfire. And I know where they're shooting from because they're using the building as cover. They're shooting from around the corner. Now, what that means is that if you start to plan correctly, and I'm not saying that they aren't, but there's an opportunity there to say, guys, and I said to them, guys, you need to put a CCTV camera facing that building on that corner because that's what they're using for cover. Put another camera looking in that direction because the mere presence of that CCTV equipment that's looking at the right spot on that building means that the shooter will not be able to shoot from there. He's either going to have to choose a different location or stop shooting altogether. Now, that's the kind of stuff that we need to be doing. You know, and when you start to use ShotSpotter around that planning of where do you put CCTV or even to know that let's put a vehicle with the blue lights on at Friday, Saturday, and Sunday between 10 and 2 o'clock in the morning in the middle of that park, the shooting goes away. So I share your frustration, and I think the guys are doing their best. There is a resource constraint, and I think therein lies the opportunity. And again, what I'd also like to stress with ShotSpotter is that there may be a concern that, you know, when you see this level of gunfire, it can sometimes feel overwhelming. And we accept that resources are limited, but if you use this data as empirical information to go to those who are in power and say, guys, this is what we're actually dealing with. We cannot solve this problem with two vehicles and four guys. Can't be done. And even if you put those four guys, you're going to burn them out in 3 months. They will not be able to do their job. So I think by using this information to motivate for additional resources based on the actual level of gunfire violence, that's the opportunity that I think we need to try and exploit.
Thank you. So the system, in essence, is reactive as well as proactive.
Exactly.
It helps decision makers to determine how opportunities for crime can be reduced as well.
Absolutely.
Are there any other questions, members? Mr. Morris, would you like to make any input?
Chairperson, maybe just to say that we've had many of these conversations also in the newly established Anti-Gangsterism Priority Committee that functions under the auspice of the Provincial Intelligence and Operations Committee, chaired jointly by Colonel Aaron from the Defence Force, as well as General Jula. And I think what we've identified now, again, the technology works exceptionally well. Of course, when we look at the data of Mannenberg and the shootings, one needs to also be mindful of the number of murders and killings in communities like Nyanga, and so that do not have access to the technology. So therefore, it's not an absolute assignment of resources, but we all agree that we desperately need to align the resources. I think the biggest challenge facing us now, Chair, is the lack of a formal agreement between the city and the police on how these matters will be responded. We see, I think, as been mentioned, there is better cooperation at the station level, but we need to have certain standards agreed to on how police will receive the information and how they will use it and report on each of these cases. I think if we can have that barrier removed, do you understand that currently the information is given to SAPS, but there's no accountability if they do not respond to the cases, despite it, the resource challenges, that we agree. But without that accountability and that ability to come back to this committee and give you an action plan and also detailing how police are responding to these matters, I think the technology, as wonderful as it may be, I think is underutilized. It's not seeing the effect that we were hoping to see through this technology.
I think that then exhausts the comments and questions.
Chair, if I may add,
yes,
that, it came up yesterday in our discussions with Director Roberts around the measurements of gang violence. Often when one looks at crime statistics, we sort of look at murders and attempted murders and gun-related or gunshot injuries. Yeah, and that is the sort of thing that hits the spreadsheet. But yeah, it's important to note that discharging a firearm in a built-up area is a criminal offence. And as a result, that in itself should be, that's the case. You know, somebody fires a firearm, so somebody should be investigating that. Yeah, and it's sort of like Mayor Giuliani's broken window approach. Yeah, when you deal with, you say, even though you might not have hit somebody or wounded somebody, the fact that you fired a firearm in a built-up area which puts the public at risk, you are now need to be held accountable. That needs to be registered as a case. We understand there are resource constraints. Yeah, can you investigate 500 shooting incidents which are simply the discharging of firearms in 7 square kilometers in 30 days? We understand that, but I think that's what we need to work towards, just sort of say, even just firing a gun, it's wrong. Yeah, and then then firing a gun to kill somebody is obviously much, much more wrong. I mean, I know that's not English, but yeah, you get what I'm saying. And I think that's what we need to work towards and try to get people to buy into.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lester and Mr. Clark, for joining us this morning. We're very grateful for your time.
Sure.
And I know it's late at night for you, Mr. Clark, so thank you very much for the time that you spent with the committee as well, and thank you for answering all our questions. And we look forward to the second part of our visit to see your technology in action, and we'll also be able to pose questions on those response times and the relationship with SAPS and get to the bottom of that. So I think I think we're going to adjourn for 10 minutes. We have some refreshments outside, so if members would like to engage with Mr. Lester or Mr. Morris over refreshments for 10 minutes, you're most welcome. And then committee members will just return for our deliberations and our administration.
Fantastic. Thank you, Ralph. I appreciate you.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have a great day today.
Thank you.
Take care. Cheers.
Meeting is adjourned.